This is Georgia Focus, a public affairs presentation of this radio station and the Georgia News Network. For the next 30 minutes, we'll feature a discussion about an issue of importance and relevance to you and your neighbors across Georgia.
Welcome to Georgia Focus. I'm John Clark on the Georgia News Network. The Top 10 Issues to Watch is an annual publication of the Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education. The list of issues for 2019 was released on Friday. And here to talk about the issues for this year is Dr. Dana Rickman, Vice President of Policy and Research for the Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education. Dana, good to see you.
It's good to see you, too. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. We were talking about this, and we think this might be the 10th or 11th year that we've had you guys on in the first part of the year. So it's great.
Yeah, I think so. This is our 15th edition of the Top 10, but I think this is number 10 or 11 for us to sit and talk about the issues.
That's right. We start out the year, and we always know it's a new year when you guys come in and talk to us. This was going to be an interesting year because you have a new governor coming in and a lot of new people coming in. So but before we get to that and talking about that, who gets this report? You just had the symposium on Friday, and who does this go out to?
Oh, we did. We kicked it off on Friday with our media symposium. And, you know, it's a really wide, diverse audience that receives the top 10 issues. We try to take really complex issues and make them very straightforward and easy to understand. And so, of course, we target like legislators and other policymakers, but we also target other advocates, parents, educators, anybody who's interested in learning more about what's going on in education policy, and even some education policy schools are using it for their sort of overview classes for public policy.
Once you release this, or I should go back and say, do you take a look at previous years, like last year's, and see how well you did? Is there sort of a bellwether to see what you did?
To a certain extent. At the very beginning of the book, we have these indicators to watch to see how Georgia's doing on really key indicators of educational success, things like third grade reading, eighth grade math, post-secondary attainment. And so we try to track that every year. And we feel that if we're, as a state, really serious about the issues that we're bringing up every year, that we'll see some positive movement across most of those indicators. And I'm happy to say that we're moving in a positive direction and have been for a couple of years.
We'll start out with a list. And I know these are not really in any particular order, but this year, the number one one, and I alluded to there being a new administration coming in. And this one, the top one, if there was a number one, this could probably be it. It's called New Leadership, Changes at the Capitol. What are you anticipating?
You know, absolutely, changes in leadership. You know, we've had some real steady, even-handed leadership from Governor Nathan Deal over the past 8 years. And so we kind of knew what to expect and where we wanted to go in terms of education policy. But obviously, we have a new governor that has just been elected. And with that comes a whole new opportunity for different kinds of policies within education. And it's not just the governor that's new. Within his power, the governor is going to appoint either the leader or the boards of most of our education agencies as well. And so we'll see a lot of new leadership at the state level. We'll also have new leaders in the Senate and the House education committees. They hold a lot of power over which issues are taken up, which issues are passed or move forward out of committee. And so just a lot of new faces. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens.
It will be. And I know this happens with every administration change, but this time around you had a lot of seats change hands that maybe you wouldn't ordinarily have. So it's going to be interesting to watch how that plays out.
Yeah, the one consistency that we do have is that state school superintendent Richard Woods was reelected for another 4 years. So he'll continue to head up the Department of Education. And he's been pretty clear about his priorities. There's been nothing in the Kemp campaign so far that has really, you know, challenged or contradicted the direction that Woods has taken DOE. So we'll probably see some pretty good consistency on K-12, though the new governor will be appointing new members of the State Board of Education, who also has to work with Superintendent Woods. And so we'll see how those relationships play out.
And I know Governor-elect Kemp has said he wants to give teachers a raise, so that's probably welcome news. We'll see how that goes as well.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. He's made during the campaign, none of the candidates were really specific about education in general. Toward the end of the election, they started to give a few more specifics, and then now Governor-elect Kemp has gotten even a little more specific. But he's really shown a commitment to early learning, early literacy. That has been a bellwether of Governor Deal's, and he's committed to continuing that. He wants to focus on school safety, and the one that you mentioned, this increased pay for teachers, which of course, teachers are very excited about. It remains to be seen how that's going to be funded or how that's going to actually play out, but we'll see.
The second one is early learning, quality care, and its economic impact.
Yeah, you know, we've been hearing for a long time about the benefits of early care and high-quality early learning for the students that participate, you know, the long-term investment kinds of things. But there have been a couple of recent studies over this past year that have really looked at sort of the bottom-line economic impact. And a survey that was done by GEARS and the Metro Atlanta Chamber of Commerce surveyed parents of small children. And they found that there's a significant impact of parents' ability to maintain work, go to work training, go to college, and connected to the availability of early care. And they found that there's an annual loss to the state economy estimated at about $1.75 billion due to instability of quality child care. Right. And so that's a real economic problem that we're facing. And so the issue really digs into what can be done about that.
That's really interesting how, from the economic standpoint, you know, that did they correlate it with parents going back to work or not going back to work? Is that essentially what it is?
Yeah. And so, you know, you see a lot of, especially outside of metro area, a lot of the rural growth jobs are in manufacturing, or if you're in like the medical fields, things like that. That requires a lot of shift work. Most early care and child care locations are only open, you know, during the day.
Yeah.
So nighttime work, weekend work, if you can't find a safe place for your child while you're working, you can't commit to your career. A lot of times, too, if your child is sick, do you have sick leave from work to take care of your child? Things like that. And so just the stability of care and accessibility of care is a major problem for a lot of people.
The third top 10 issue to watch for this year is teaching. We always have something, of course, about the teachers. And this year, it's elevating the profession now with an exclamation point. So that indicates urgency.
Yes, exactly. I think most teachers out in your listening audience would agree that there's been a lot of lip service over the past couple of years. Everybody's saying we need to treat teachers like professionals. Let's elevate the profession. Like, they are a profession. Though, as a state, we haven't gotten down to actually doing that. And so what this issue looks at is the different, what are the elements of a profession? Competitive wages, you know, other types of benefits, long-term career path, things like that, that education professionals really aren't seeing relative to other professions of equal, you know, education level and things like that. So this issue really looks at what's going on with our pay structure, what's going on with the retirement and the benefits, how do we keep teachers in the classroom but yet provide them a career pathway so they can get more, you know, grow in their job, things like that, that all professionals look for in a career.
We're losing a lot of teachers to retirement. I guess we always are. It's constantly changing, but
yeah,
more
we're
so.
Losing a lot to retirement, but we're also losing a lot early on in their career. And I'm not sure that that's specific to teaching. You know, we talk about the new career path of millennials. Like, people
right.
don't stay in the same career for 30 plus years like they used to. And so the teaching profession has been built upon that. And so what do we need to do to make teaching a field that people want to go into, want to stay into, find it personally rewarding, all of these kinds of things? I don't think that we've really taken a hard look at to try and address.
Number four is interesting, school safety, much more than metal detectors. Obviously huge to have kids safe at school, and probably something is becoming more challenging too, but expand on that.
There are a lot of headlines around school safety, and most of them have to do with these dramatic, horrible acts, mm-hmm. you know, the school shootings and the violence and
right.
things like that. But school safety is much broader than just these random acts and that we read about. And so for a fully safe environment, a lot of it has to do with school climate, school culture, making students feel connected, looking at the mental health of the students, but the faculty as well, and sort of a community aspect. And so this issue really looks at how complicated this particular issue is, and that certainly physical measures must be taken to keep schools safe
right.
and to keep weapons and things like that out of school. But it's a much broader topic, looking at bullying and drugs and gangs and violence, and how do you coordinate across a community and resources across the state to make students feel connected, feel valued, want to be there, want to participate.
Certainly, that is something the law enforcement community would, has to have a seat at the table as well.
Oh, absolutely. It goes well beyond just the particular school resources. In fact, throughout 2018, a Senate study committee met thinking about different recommendations that the state would want to do around promoting school safety. And they looked a lot at crisis prevention. So things like we've heard about, like mental health counselors and things like that. But a lot of it, too, was around recommendations of data sharing and coordinating local first responders with community members, with parents, with mental health professionals. It's a very broad collection of people that need to be involved.
Number five, very, very important, funding. We always talk about that. Somehow it always comes up. Funding, is fully funding QBE enough?
That's a good question. We're not sure. I will give credit to our former governor, Nathan Deal, that in his last year in office, he was able to what we call fully fund the QBE, which is our quality basic education formula. It's how we fund public education. And he put an end to what we had in the policy world, you know, talked about austerity cuts. And so that formula is now fully funded. The question is, and the question that we raise in this issue, is how much does a basic education actually cost? We know what the state is willing to spend on public education, but we've not done any studies on what it actually costs. And so we know that children living in poverty, for example, cost more to educate, not because they're not as smart, but because they come with additional challenges around food and clothing and shelter, or gifted and talented students, for example. Different populations cost different amounts. We don't know what those costs are. And so to sort of randomly put a number on what we're willing to spend without being tied to what are the actual costs of the outcomes we're looking for, we need to have a better understanding of that. We may be at a point where we are adequately funding, but we may not be. And so we need to look at that.
Funding will certainly come up, I'm sure, in the legislative session with all the changes, too, of course.
Yeah.
Today we are talking with Dr. Dana Rickman. She is the Vice President of Policy and Research for the Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education. They've just released their top 10 issues to watch in education for 2019. So we are going over that and getting some insight into those issues. Something that we've talked about before is assessments. Too much, not enough. You know, how do we balance that out? That's the sixth one. Assessments, testing the waters.
Yeah, we're still talking about assessments.
Yeah.
This is one that, you know, there's been a lot of sort of back and forth on assessments, and there used to be a lot of, you know, a couple of years ago, a lot of controversy around sort of the end of course test. And this debate now is a little bit different. We're not sort of pros and cons of testing, but why are we testing and what do we do with them? You know, we have the Georgia milestones, which are end of year high stakes tests, but there's a lot of concern that those tests are not particularly helpful in terms of helping teachers and educators inform their instruction with students, and that perhaps we've gotten a little over-reliant on sort of end-of-course, end-of-grade tests, and that we need to think about more what they call formative assessments, which are given throughout the year that really help teachers and other educators gauge, are students learning? Do I need to change my instruction? And so it's not a matter of how much testing, but why are we testing? Are the tests useful? Are they being used in a meaningful way? Issues like that. And so Georgia as a state are looking at different types of waivers from the federal government to do some different experiments around what kind of tests we want to give and how do we ultimately want to use assessments in education.
Have we had tests before that are really, that weren't really used? They just test for the sake of testing?
Yeah. That's an interesting question. At the Georgia Partnership, we helped a couple of districts do what we call an assessment inventory to really sort of map out all the tests that they're giving. And what they found was they were giving a lot of needless tests where they would have an assessment coordinator come in and say, you know, X, Y, and Z is my favorite test. Everybody has to do it. So they did. Then that coordinator would leave and a new coordinator would come and they'd have a different test that they want, but they wouldn't get rid of the old ones.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of sort of duplicative testing, a lot of testing that goes on that the teachers don't really understand why they're administering it other than they were told to, those kinds of things. So I think there's a lot of streamlining that we can do. I think assessments can be incredibly valuable. They can be a very important tool for instruction and learning. But I think as a state, we really need to get a handle on what we're currently doing and what we ultimately want to do.
Yeah.
And that's where this issue really tries to get into the weeds.
And number seven, ESA/vouchers. taking a hard look at what's next. Vouchers, we hear a lot about vouchers in education, have for years, probably won't go away anytime soon. Expand on that one.
Yeah, you know, this issue really looks at choice and parent choice and the different kinds of options that parents have for enrolling their kids in public schools or private schools. The issue of charter schools is sort of the original choice option. That's largely settled in Georgia, really no longer controversial, and charters are sort of there. Sort of this new frontier of choice are around these vouchers and education savings accounts and things like that. And in Georgia, we have the special needs scholarship, which is a voucher, which was established in 2007 to allow public school students with special needs to transfer to other schools that could better meet their needs. So it's the traditional voucher that we think about. Also in Georgia, we have these tax credit scholarships, and we have two. We have the Georgia Private School Tax Credit, which allows individuals or businesses to donate money to what we call an SSO, which is a student scholarship organization. Those SSOs distribute those monies to as private school scholarships to eligible students. That's pretty typical of how those work. What's kind of exciting in Georgia, this last legislative session in 2018, we set up the Qualified Education Donation Tax Credit, which is operates similarly to the SSOs, but that money actually goes back to public schools, especially those who are chronically struggling and needing more resources to turn themselves around. So if people want to invest directly in public schools, they can donate to the Qualified Education Donation Tax Credit. Yeah. So those are some different options that are out there in Georgia.
How do they do that? How do they make a donation for that?
It's through the Governor's Office of Student Achievement. Okay. And they can find more information on GOSA's website.
You know, you mentioned charter schools, and not too long ago, just a few years ago, they were so new and there weren't many around, and now they're everywhere. They've really grown all over the place.
Yeah, I think that Georgia's done a really good job of really trying to hold charter schools to the same standard, if not a higher standard, than our regular non-charter public schools. And so the charters now really have to prove that they are of high quality, of sound financial management. And so I think with that level of transparency that we have, people are a lot more comfortable with charters, and especially a lot of the ones in the urban areas have shown that they really can turn a student's life around and with the additional flexibility that they have. So I think a lot of the anxiety around charters has really died down.
Number 8, very interesting. Everybody says, who knows when kids start back? This system starts one day, this system starts another day. They go back too early now. So many different things. Summer start date, more than meets the eye. I want to hear about this one.
You know, this one is really interesting. When we first started writing on this, honestly, I thought, I can't believe I'm writing about summer start date. Who cares when school goes back, right? But it really is a lot more than meets the eye, which is the impetus here. There was a study committee that was led by the legislature about should we sort of mandate summer start days. So it's really not all over the place. You know, we have 181 different school districts, and they generally right now start within about a two-week window around the 1st of August. But it really is all over the place of when they start and when they end. And so the study committee was really looking at what if we moved it to starting around Labor Day, kind of, you know, get them all together. And that has really big implications, especially for the tourist industry, mm-hmm. because a lot of places like Six Flags, their workforce typically are students, like high school students, sure. who have gone back to school first of August, and then a lot of family vacations around August. There were other concerns as well around it's as hot as Georgia is. July and August in particular are really hot. And so there's issues on safety of, you know, air conditioning of the school buses, the athletic teams that have to exercise outside. So they're really diving into this question about when should we start. But when you look at it more deeply, there are sort of legitimate reasons why schools have backed up their calendar to beginning of August. Many school districts have sort of an extended year calendar. It's still 180 days, but they have more breaks during the year, and so there's a shorter summer. And the reasons for that is to cut down on what we call summer learning loss. You're out of school, you kind of forget stuff.
Right.
There is really, especially in the rural areas, a real lack of summer learning opportunities, stuff to do in the summer. Access to summer quality programming is very limited, and where it is, it's very expensive. So there's some equity issues there as well. And then there's issues around, you know, local control and local priority. You know, for example, Houston County schools schedule their fall break to coincide with the state fair. It's a really big deal for them, with a lot of 4-H kids and things like that. Richmond County schedules their spring break around the Masters. Right. And so there's a lot of local issues too. And so to mandate a calendar, it's a lot more complicated than it seems obvious. So everybody just start after Labor Day.
So we're going to keep hearing that for the foreseeable.
Yeah, and right after Christmas, the study committee issued a recommendation that I think they're going to seek some legislation this coming session around recommending that schools adopt a calendar where they start within about 10 days of Labor Day and then end up sometime around the 1st of June. And so it's not as prescriptive, this proposed recommendation, as a lot of people feared, but it's still kind of trying to consolidate everybody a little more succinctly and maybe not those first bloody hot weeks of August.
Yeah.
And so we'll see. It's not official yet. We'll see where the debate goes. But there's a lot of odd tension around this one.
Yeah, it really is. And there's a lot of, obviously, there are a lot of intricacies involved, as you just outlined, too. Number 9, dual enrollment, growth and sustainability. Dual enrollment is becoming much more popular now. And so expand on that one.
You know, it's really popular, and it's growing like crazy. You know, dual enrollment, for those in our audience that may not know, it allows high school students to basically, you know, gain college credit and take college courses while they're still in high school. And it's an incredibly popular program. In fact, total attempted credit hours have risen by over 200% since 2013. And also with that, we've had a lot of rising costs. The dual enrollment appropriations have increased over 300% in the past 5 years. And so it's a popular program. It's a very expensive program. And so this issue really looks at, can we scale it? Can we as a state, can we sustain it? Who's benefiting from it? You know, what are some of the challenges as any program grows? What are some of the challenges that we'll be looking for to try to sustain it and make sure everybody has access to it?
I didn't realize, well, I know it's going to have some cost, but I didn't realize it was, you know, putting such a drain that it was that expensive to do that.
Well, it is, and one of the reasons is that because students are attending basically two institutions, their home school, their K-12 school, and either a school within our technical college system or our university system. And so the state essentially has to pay twice to support that. And so those are some costs that are associated with it.
Number 10, and again, I emphasize that these are not in any particular order, really, but they have to be in some order, certainly. The 10th one and the final one is post-secondary, cost and other barriers impede.
Yeah, this 10th and final one, again, looks at post-secondary. We've all heard about, you know, the increasing tuition, though while Georgia is relative to other states, our in-state tuition is relatively low. But Georgia has a growing population of poor students. And the looking at barriers to completion, a lot of it is around just the cost of tuition, but much of it is so much more. And so we've looked at, you know, things like just the cost of living that have gone up over the past couple of years. And so if students are even able to get the tuition money together, a lot of times students are unable to complete their post-secondary because, you know, they couldn't pay the electric bill or they got a flat tire. And so there was a couple, you know, $100 that they owed in fees that they couldn't cover. And so it's much more than just tuition, but these other sort of hidden cost barriers that especially low-income students are looking at that keep them from completing. Georgia is one of only two states in the country that does not have a statewide needs-based aid program for post-secondary. We do have some need-based programs out there, but not a statewide one. Our Hope Scholarship is very popular, but is not needs-based, it's merit-based, and it tends to disproportionately go to upper-income students. And so there's a real need for some more supports to get more students through post-secondary so that they can then, you know, be part of the economy.
I guess that's something I've never thought of, because you think, well, if you don't have the money to do that, you think, well, it's not that much, but it is if you don't have the money to do that.
It is, and you know, programs like Georgia State University have done a fantastic job of really looking at some of their high-risk students. And by high-risk, I mean usually, you know, low-income students or first-generation college students who don't understand all of these sort of associated cost of going to post-secondary and have increased their graduation rates exponentially. And a lot of them are saying, they're saying that sometimes it's the average sort of increased need is around $1,200 per student to get them sort of that gap funding that they need. And a lot of times it's just for a particular fee or some lab books that are, you know, very, very expensive that low-income students just can't afford.
Well, that's a list for this year. Very, very interesting list this year. And I know so much to watch, not only watching the issues, but watching what the new changes at the Capitol are. And I know that you guys at the Georgia Partnership are going to be watching very carefully, of course, as always.
Yes. And if people are interested in the report, they can download one online. They can go to www.gpee.org. And download a copy, or if they want hard copies, they can contact our office, which is on the website, and we'd be happy to mail some.
Well, we're off to the races on the top 10 list then, and thanks so much, Dana, for coming in today. As always, good to see you every year, and the very interesting list, so thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and we'll see you next year.
Great. Today we've been talking about the top 10 issues to watch in the area of education. It's an annual publication of the Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education, and today our guest has been Dr. Dana Rickman. She is Vice President of Policy and Research for the Georgia Partnership for Excellence in Education, and we thank her for joining us, and thank you for joining us as well. I'll talk to you next week here on Georgia Focus.
You've been listening to Georgia Focus, a public affairs presentation of this station and the Georgia News Network. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of this station or the Georgia News Network. If you have comments or questions about Georgia Focus, contact John Clark at the Georgia News Network at 1-800-776-4638 or email johnclark@georgianewsnetwork.com. Thanks for listening.